from me. Can we give her a warm green belt welcome to Danny Dorley?
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for coming. Let's see if we can do an hour on Brexit without getting cross. If we can't do it here, we can't do it anywhere. I often think that anybody who's tired of Brexit is tired of life. It's exciting. Do you know how boring it used to be? Yeah. When we knew what was going to happen and it was the same old thing, or you could alter it slightly. Two political parties would vie for an election with slightly different manifestos. You know, one would win, everything carried on much the same. Whereas now none of you know what is going to happen next month, the month after, the month after. I don't know either. So, in anticipation of questions, I'm sure you're going to want to ask me what will happen, Danny. But Brexit is brilliant in that it's humbling for academics. No academic predicted it. None. And that is quite remarkable. Quite a lot of people want to say they did after the event. It's just that they didn't write it down anywhere. So, it's humbling. Why didn't we predict it? Because we got too arrogant, I think. We thought we got quite good at predicting things. Well, not us, not the actual academics. We cheated. What we started to do is that we used the spread betting. Spread betting works when you put your money down and actually say, I think we're going to leave on the 31st of October, and the bookies alter the odds depending on how much money people put down. And the spread betting, particularly in the US, but also in the UK, had become more and more accurate. People are quite good at predicting when they're actually putting their own cash down. And the spread betting said that Remain were going to win by 2 or 3%. And so we all comfortably thought they would. Now in hindsight, had Remain won by 2 or 3%, we would almost certainly still be in chaos. Because in hindsight, quite clearly, we now know what we didn't know was that a group of people really, really, really wanted to leave. Enough to vote in 52% of those who voted, but behind the 52% who voted leave was a very determined group of men, largely men, some with quite a lot of money, and they saw this as a long-term project. Why do I think they saw it as a long-term project? Because they were shocked. If you remember the day of the referendum, Michael Gove and Boris Johnson standing there, and the look on their faces, they hadn't expected to win. Their personal plans, I think, and here I'm guessing, a lot of things I'm going to say are guesswork, I'll show you some facts. Hopefully on the screen, is there a bar graph on the screen?
Yes.
Great, okay. I'm not going to rely on you being able to see what's on the screen, so don't worry if you can't see it. It's a comfort blanket for me. We'll just try to convince you I'm not just making this up. Boris Underhill. He famously wrote two editorials, one in favour of Remain, one in favour of Leave, and then in the Telegraph he published the one in favour of Leave. Boris, I think, and you may disagree with me, was very, very, very interested in himself. And he was trying to work out what stance he should take to maximise the chance of him achieving what he always wanted to achieve, which was to beat his mate Dave. Dave and Boris were at university together. Dave was slightly better at socialising and going out. Dave was cool and trendy. Dave went up the county road. Dave occasionally inhaled. Doesn't say what he inhaled, a bit like Boris says he thought it was icing sugar. And they competed for attention in Oxford. But when they left, Boris was angry because Dave was given a first-class degree and Boris was given a 2-1. And ever since then, he's been trying to get his own back. Anyway, they didn't expect to win. If they had expected to win, they would have a plan. They also would not have done things which were illegal. I can say illegal as they've been found to be illegal. You would have covered your tracks. You'd have been a bit more clever. But if you'd been expecting just to get 48-49%, and then campaign for a second referendum to leave, you wouldn't worry so much about that because there wouldn't have been investigations. As it is, what happened, I think, is quite fortunate. And this is partly why I say about Brexit being funny. I should say this point before I upset anybody. My view is that people will die. So it's not that funny. Except that people have already started dying. The life expectancy in this country peaked in 2014 for both men and women. Since then it's fallen. We are still not back at the level it was at in 2014. Infant mortality began rising in this country for the first time since the Second World War, seriously, in 2015, the year before the referendum. It was 3.5 babies per thousand. Quite small by international standards, still twice the rate of Scandinavia. Then went up to 3.6, 3.7, 3.8, it's now 3.9 babies per thousand dying in this country. One of the worst rates in Europe. These are all the kind of things that we don't talk about because of Brexit. If you want a contrast, which I think is interesting, in Scotland, which traditionally has higher infant mortality even than England, it's actually gone down from 4 to 3.2. Now you can't read that much into these things, but I tend to. The remarkable thing at the moment is that we are on course to be the only nation, England this is, nation in Europe, to be heading towards United States levels of infant mortality, poverty, inequality. Scotland is currently on course in about 10 years' time, if it manages it, to compete with Finland, Norway and Sweden on those statistics. All kinds of interesting things are going on right now. So what explained the vote? Now, the academic who produced this graph got lynched. But I will show you. The graph was produced 3 weeks after the referendum. Those at the front should be able to see the wording, those at the back can't. I'll tell you what the wording is in a minute. This is the highest correlation with the Leave vote for local authorities across the country. So on one axis you've got the proportion of people voted Leave, and on the other axis you've got the proportion of people who are obese or overweight. Correlation of 0.8. If you wonder what obese and overweight is, I, for the purposes of this talk, very carefully keep my weight almost exactly between obese and overweight. Now the highest correlation. There are many, many other geographical explanations. I'm a geographer, that's why I'm showing you a geographical correlation. There are many other explanations for this, but this was the one that did best. And the academic managed to write a blog for the LSE, which was then picked up, I think, in the Daily Express and the Sun and the Star, who ripped him apart because he suggested that people who are fatter like me are a little bit more feckless. We don't tend to plan ahead. If we see that extra bag of crisps, we go for it. And if somebody offers us leaves, we go for that too. Now, what I can tell you is that this absolutely is not the reason why the UK left, and it's not the reason why these areas were more likely to vote Leave. For a start, it was actually an estimate of how fat people are, produced by Public Health England. They didn't have brilliant data, and some of their data they used to proxy being fat is data that's actually quite good for proxying Leave. But if you want to know why the correlation is so high, I'll tell you about the second highest correlation, which is with immigration, 0.79, almost 0.8. And it's the opposite way round to people thought. The fewer immigrants, that is somebody born in another country living in your area, the fewer immigrants there were where you lived, the more likely you were to vote Leave.
Yes.
Now, why has that got anything to do with being fat? Can the immigrants in the room, these are people born outside of the UK, could they put their hands up please? Should be older. Lovely, look at you. Now I'm doing a quick survey in my head, and you are on average thinner. Why should that be? Why are immigrants thinner? I live in Oxford. I am reminded every day about how annoyingly thin immigrants are. I used to live in the north of England. I was much more average inside there. Well, one simple thing is immigrants tend to be young, in their 20s and 30s. And people tend to be thinner when they're young. But it's not just that. Immigrants have this annoying get up and go kind of behaviour and attitude. They are actually, on average, different. You can all be immigrants. You just go somewhere else to live, another country. Those of you who do it, and there will be people in this room who do that, will have more get up and go than the people who choose not to do that. There are all kinds of relationships between people who want to move more and move less. The immigrants tend to be thinner. So that's why we get that correlation of 0.8 with being fat. Nothing to do with being fat. For the pedants in the room, I'm sure we've got some pedants. This is the correlation with deprivation. 0.03. That is nothing. There is no relationship between being poor and voting Leave. Right? And one thing that's just funny about Brexit is even though this referendum happened over 3 years ago, we still don't actually know what happened. We have all these myths about people in Stoke and Middlesbrough and Sheffield and Sunderland voting the country out. All complete rubbish. That's really easy to show because we know how many people voted to leave and to stay in each part of the country. The majority of Leave voters, 59% of them, were social class A, B, C, 1. Leave was a middle class vote. The majority of Leave voters lived in the south of England. No matter whether you define the south, using a diagonal line across the country, or a flat line across the country. I've just driven across Leave Central. Oxford to Kettering, heart of Britain. As soon as I got past, I think, 5 miles outside of Oxford, I didn't have to dirty myself touching Remain areas at all. All the way here, it felt really good in English. You go, here's another one for you. Little blue dots, little red dots. This is constituencies now, so the dots are all the same size. Again, you've got Remain on one side, and I think you've got deprivation on the other. The red dots are constituencies to vote Labour. You'll see no pattern there at all. The red dots really are random. The blue dots are constituencies to vote Conservative. And there you can begin to see something in it. Poorer Conservative constituencies. Now, no constituency other than Hastings is poor and votes Conservative, right? And Amberbert's not going to be there much longer. But poorer Conservative constituencies are it. That's who voted out. Not the posh ones in London. Not the ones where people go skiing twice at Christmas. And it's really within inconvenience, though. But solid, Tory, upper working class, lower middle class, old, particularly male. And old's the other thing. As you'll know, it was mainly a vote of people over 55. Where do you think most old people in the UK live? They live in the south of England, right? This is what causes it. The amazing thing is that this myth that it was the north and it was the poor is still there. The working class were more likely not to vote than to vote Leave. Yes, if they voted, a majority voted Leave, but most didn't vote. Turnout was really, really important. And the one thing that old people do, particularly old people who normally vote Conservative, do religiously, is they go and vote. What's it all about? Let's go back. And I've only got 10 more minutes, you'll be glad to know. Why us? There's 28 countries in the EU. If one was going to leave, you would have expected it to be a small country, because it's harder for a big, more integrated country to leave. You'd have thought it'd be Greece or Portugal. Oh yeah, somewhere on the edge, somewhere suffering a financial crisis. But it was us. Now, one other place has left. Didn't actually leave the EU, because the EU didn't exist. It left the European Economic Community. And that other place spent 3 years negotiating, and it came to a deal. And the deal was pretty good. We are sending €550 every year for every child in that place to help them educate themselves, to help them go to school. The people in that place all have the right to come here and work. They've still got free movement, but we can't go there necessarily. And what do we get in return? We get fish. That place is Greenland, right? Greenland knows how to do deals. Greenland did a successful deal, yeah. I don't think that man, even fatter than me in the United States, quite realises how good they are in Greenland at doing deals. But the point is that they had something to bargain with. They had fish. Lots of fish. Now this is a bit miserable on the funny side, although it is quite funny, because without Brexit we would have never realised this. We don't have fish. And we don't have the world's most brilliant car plants. And we don't have universities that they're absolutely dying to get into from the continent, as much as we like to say they are. In my university, there are lots of people from abroad, but they're from China, Malaysia, America. Why would you come to an English university where you have to pay a fortune when you get free university education on the mainland, so they don't come? But we've got our banks. Surely they're going to miss our banks, we thought. Well, it turns out no. And that's a really ironic thing, and it's quite funny. The political party, which had been the party of the bankers, the Conservative Party, the party was essentially owned by the bankers, is doing the one thing most likely to break the monopoly of London on European banking. I'm going to zoom forward, show you a couple more slides, and then I'll stop. There we go. Here's donors, the largest political donors in the country, and who they donate to? Yeah, without exception. Really well-organised party, the longest existing political party in the world of any significance. Won the majority of elections over the last century, you know, even managed, as Margaret Thatcher said, at one point to turn the Labour Party into something that did what she sort of approved of. Amazingly successful political party. Comes to this. As yet, not a single Conservative MP has yet voted no confidence in a leader in recent years. Very, very rigid party, know all about discipline. But if anything was going to break them, this is what it will be. And one thing which I find funny about Brexit, because as you can probably tell, I'm not a fan of the Conservative Party, is it could be this that brings the traditional Conservative Party and everything it stands for to an end. Why? Why don't I like the Conservative Party? I'll tell you in European terms. All European countries have a Conservative Party. It's a normal thing to have. There are always people who believe in order, rigour, being frugal, saving, looking after yourself and so on, not letting the feckless get too much. I'm not one of those people. I understand there always will be people. And everywhere in the world where there is democracy, there is a Conservative Party. However, in 2014, under David Cameron, our Conservative Party left the European bloc of Conservative Parties, the EPP. This is quite staggering. And it joined an alliance in 2014 with a set of far-right European parties in the European Parliament including at that time Alternative for Deutschland, who were neo-Nazi. The effect of the Conservatives leaving in 2014 was that if you add up Conservatives and UKIP, we sent by far the largest number of far-right MEPs to the European Parliament of any country. The largest number and the largest proportion. We became the bedrock. This, from Kettering down to Oxford. We became the bedrock of the European far-right. We were its strongest base. The really good news, from my point of view, is that if you look at the latest European elections, the ones that were held in May of this year, and you combine the Conservative Party, which is far right by European standards and behaviour and alliances, with UKIP, which is the same, with the Brexit Party, which is the same, the three of them managed to lose 11 seats. That is the biggest, fastest fall in far right support ever in the history of post-war Europe. That was quite incredible. At the same time, Labour lost 10 seats. So people didn't notice so much. But it's really interesting. And at the same time, this country, England, which used to be the least pro-European of all the countries of Europe, now has the highest proportion of people who are committed Europeans in the entire continent. None of it you could predict. Let me put up a last slide for you and then conclude and see what you want to ask. I should say something about empire. I've got lots of pictures. All these pictures are from that book. Sally Tomlinson and I, like many, many, many other academics, immediately began writing a book. And that's what we do. We go, oh, thank God, we can write about something different. The referendum has happened, and we started to write a book. We were fortunate. The publisher who'd actually suggested that we write the book, when they saw our manuscript, didn't like it. Partly had a book written with a very similar title, I later worked out, by somebody who used to be head of the number 10 policy unit, who ranked slightly above us. Sally Tomlinson, by the way, she's a professor of education. She specialises in textbooks in particular, and in what was written in the textbooks that all of you would have been taught at school in different subjects, including geography. And not only that, she drills down. There's a little prep school, I think in Surrey, where a young Boris Johnson went. And she's got his textbook. And if you want to know where Watermelon Smiles comes from, the phrase, it's in that book. And Piccadilly's, and so on. So Sally's interested in how we come to believe what we come to believe. Why us? Greenland, you can see the point. They could come to a good deal, they were a long, long way away, and you never know, they could one day sell themselves to America. That's unlikely. What's different about us? Well, a couple of things. First of all, we're the country in Europe with the fastest declining living standards. The fastest declining standards of living, most obviously measured by health, but you can measure it in all other kinds of ways. People being sanctioned, the biggest rise of people on the streets. The only European country with the same number of people sleeping rough is Germany, and same proportion. It's not because Germany's bigger. Why does Germany have as many people on the streets as we do?
Asylum seekers.
Exactly. Half of them are from Syria, right? How many did we let in? Nobody. 1.5 million people Germany let in. Didn't quite manage to house them all, so ends up with some poor sods living on the streets. We do that to our own. We are quite remarkable. If you measure the gap between rich and poor, then you can measure it in many different ways now, how much the 1% take, what the Gini coefficient is, what the 10% ratio is, doesn't matter. We are the economically most unequal country in Europe. Why do people between Oxford and Kettering vote for anything but this? Because life isn't good between Oxford and Kettering. Not for most people. They might have a home. Many of them might actually own their home. Remember, these are older people. But their children, in their 20s or 30s, are renting. Probably the way things are going for the rest of their lives. That is the predictions at the moment. Their grandchildren, if they do really well and are frugal and work hard, can go to university and amass a debt even bigger than they amass in the United States of America for the privilege of going to university, and then begin to rent from a landlord. Like the most unequal country in all of Europe, it's not perhaps surprising that people weren't happy in this country. But lastly, what I'm going to end on, we were different from all the other European countries. We had been number one in the world just 100 years ago. We were the richest. We had the highest living standards. Even for our poorest, they lived longer. When I was born in 1968, we had the lowest infant mortality in the world because we had baby incubators and nobody else had them. We were at the top. When I was 15, my school did a trip to France and we got 10 francs to the pound. There were other people my age, remember, 10 francs per pound. I was 15 years old. I had a pound. A bottle of wine was 3 francs. Like 10 francs to the pound. We lived a life of kings. And now it's 1-1, in effect, if you try to go away this summer and fall in. Why were we so rich? Why did we have the best health service? Why were things so good? It is not unrelated to the fact that we owned more of the world than anybody ever has. It was the British Empire. That is what made us rich. The problem is that we didn't tell ourselves that. We told ourselves that running the largest empire the world has ever known was some kind of gift we did. It was an act of benevolence. We brought civilizations to people. We carried on teaching this, and when we stopped teaching this, we didn't begin to teach the alternative. Gordon Brown, the former Prime Minister, has pointed out that we invaded, I think, almost, I think it could be over 180 of the countries that are now 193 members of the United Nations. We invaded almost everywhere. Nobody asked us. You know, we did one treaty in New Zealand because they were particularly good at fighting back. But really, we took over. Every child in China is taught about the history of China and why it is as it is. And they're all taught about how Palmerston's boats turned up. And when the Chinese wouldn't buy the opium that we were trying to sell them, that we were growing in India because we owned India, we shelled them through a place called Hong Kong and opened up China to opium and destroyed it. Every Chinese child is taught that. Not a single child in a school in England is taught any of this. But we became rich, really rich. And our industry did well, because our colonies had to buy from us. There was imperial preference. And it didn't all go when the colonies went. They went mostly in the 60s and a few in the 70s. But the advantage that we have carried on for a little bit. But then it slowed down because you could buy better ships that were cheaper than the ones made on the Tyne. And you could buy better cars than the ones that were made in Cowley. And you could bank with somebody who wasn't going to rip you off quite as much as the bankers in London. And we had to do something about it. And one thing we did about it was we liberalised the city of London. We said, hey, you can do what the hell you like. It was called the Big Bang in 1986. And for a time it worked. Money flooded into the country, some of it trickled down and out. Inequality rose, but it kind of worked until 2008, when that Ponzi scheme fell apart. And then we're suddenly left with ourselves. No longer with the advantage of what we once had for being the richest and most powerful nation in the world. And we turn around and we say, oh, Germany won't agree with us leaving, they'll come to a deal because they sell 1 in 10 of their cars to us. So they'll want to stay. We're closing down the car plant in Swindon. We're closing down the one at Ellesmere Port. The one 2 miles from my house is mainly made up of 1,200 robots, each one of which fits in the back of an articulated lorry. It can be moved in 2 weeks, the BMW plant at Oxford, to the Austrian-Czech border. We're producing less cars now than we were. We're still going to be buying 10% of Germany's cars in the future. It's just we'll be paying a tariff on them, and they'll be the smaller ones. And that's really good. because it's good for the environment. Right? And there are lots of plus sides to this. If we look after each other as we go through whatever it is, I personally don't think we're going to leave on the 31st. I don't think we're going to sort this out for a decade. I think it's going to be painful, agonising, embarrassing. We're going to learn just how civilised our European neighbours are as we do it, just how tolerant they are. When the army said they'd send food if there was a problem, they actually meant it. It's quite humbling to realise nobody has taken, nobody has taken the mickey out of us. And you understand the arrogance of that phrase. The first colony, of course, was Ireland that we've had. We're going to grow up. It's always difficult when you're at the heart of a former empire. Every large empire in the world has not come out of it well for a century after the end of empire. This is what we're going to have to go through now. It's a learning process. It's going to be tricky. We can deal with it simply by looking after each other, whatever happens. If it is a knife-edge Brexit on Halloween, then you have to worry about your neighbours. You have to worry about getting more food to the food banks. You have to worry about who needs insulin. And you particularly, above all else, have to worry about your friends who are not born here. And the racism which has increased in the last few years to death. If we come to some kind of deal or Norway arrangement, there won't be happiness. There will be people who claim it was betrayal of Empire 2.0 to the day they die. And again, that's going to require kindness. There'll be people who will never agree with you, no matter what your stance is over this. Because there are no winners from coming down from being top. Unless you accept that becoming a normal European country is actually something to be. We should try to be somewhere where our children can go to school and university for free. Private education largely doesn't exist on the continent. Their children mix with each other. We should try to be somewhere where the health service is properly funded. On the side of that bus, it should have read 1 billion euros. Because in Germany, they spend 1 billion euros, to be precise, 1,050 million euros every week extra on their health services as opposed to what we do. And that's not because they've got more people. France spends more. France has far more doctors per head. We spend the least of any rich European country on our health. We can aspire to be somewhere that's normal. We can aspire to at least spend the European average on our healthcare. But we can't do that and still buy aircraft carriers and swan around the world pretending we are what we no longer are. We've got a choice. And the choice is, do we move quickly to becoming normal, or do we take a long and painful time over it while we let Jacob Rees-Mogg try to play a billionaire's game of gambling to make this the offshore tax haven island, thinking that they will not notice what we are doing just over the channel? My worry is that I'll be dead before we sort this out. I would like to spend my pensionable age in a country that finally has come to realise that it isn't special. There's not a reason why we should be number one or number two in the world. We're not going to be the fifth largest economy for much longer anyway, and it can all be a much better place without all of that. Thank you very much for your attention.
It's just
so right, and we are so blessed to have you here to share just a little bit of that depth of knowledge that you have. And I'm pleased to say that we have a really good chunk of time for questions, which we love. I want to have questions, please, and not comments. I'm sure that we all hold really strong opinions about this. I would love to have a really diverse range of really snappy questions. Do you think we could do that? Ian, our wonderful techie, is going to take this side of the room, but I'm going to start with one question from this side of the room.
If you had an Irish grandmother, would you cash her in?
Would I cut her in?
Cash her in.
Would I cash her in and claim? I would like to think not, but I probably have a higher opinion of myself than me did. I keep one credit card with a £15,000 limit on it in case things ever get really badly wrong. But I grew up in the 80s. Which you may remember the 80s, at one point we were 3 minutes to midnight on the nuclear alert, so I think my power was that. I'd like to think I wouldn't. Brexit's made me actually more patriotic about England. You notice I keep on saying England, we can talk about that. Made me care about the place a bit more, because I when we were going to muck it up, I can speak no other language as well. So the only option would be Ireland for me, because I am now too old and too slow, and my wife will tell you there's absolutely no chance that I would ever manage to learn another one. So I'm stuck here. Or there are some other places that speak English that are very nice, but Brexit's actually made me feel more attached to my home and the place I was born and grew up in than before, because it makes you think about these things. It's all about geography, it's all about borders, it's all about groups.
Thank you. I think we'll now take questions in groups of two, so one from this side of the room.
I was interested in your comment about this potentially being the end of the Conservative Party. To what extent do you think the whole crisis comes down to our ancient voting system of first past the post, which forces the Tory party to be a coalition between the centre-right Tories with a brain, as it were, and the far-right wing? And that, yeah, a similar thing happens in the Labour Party.
You just mentioned that you keep talking about England. I wonder whether, no, it's me. I wonder whether you've got any thoughts about what the result told us about devolved nations, and whether you have any idea what's going to happen to the Union.
Okay, I'll do that one first and then yours. Freddie Heineken, we showed to the book, Freddie Heineken, the man who owned the Heineken Brewery, in 1992, maybe earlier, paid a couple of historians to produce a future map of Europe. He thought the big countries are too big and they should be split up, and so on. People didn't take much note of Heineken's map of Europe until Yugoslavia broke up, exactly along the lines which the historians have said it would. And in Sally and my book, we have his map. And the interesting thing isn't Scotland and Ireland, which is kind of obvious, or Wales. It's how England might break up in future. This is the best thing you could ever have done to encourage Scottish independence. It's hard to think of anything more that could be done to do it. And in a way, Scotland and England only ever came together in a marriage of convenience. It was from like 1707. We were watching all these Spanish galleons taking silver and gold from the Americas and going past us. And we were fighting each other. And we suddenly realised that if we joined up rather than fought each other, we could do a more effective job, first of pirating the silver and gold, and then actually taking over parts of the Americas. So it was a marriage of convenience to create an empire. The empire's come to an end, it doesn't kind of make much sense. There is no border in Ireland, that's what the Good Friday Agreement is about. You can't put a yoghurt pot on that line and not cause offence. There are many, many reasons for that. But we are heading for a united Ireland of some kind or other. Wales is trickier, and what happens to the England is harder. The Conservatives and our voting system is bizarre. They have an even more bizarre than the United States, so the president can be elected in with a minority of voters. But there's nowhere else, I think, in Europe which has something as antiquated as what we have. And once it breaks, it will break. The problem is that whoever tends to win under it tends for that moment in which they win to think it's okay. The Conservative Party, I think, is pretty... I wouldn't call them stupid on the far right. I have opinions about the levels of ability. The ones that worry me most are the very, very clever ones. Jeremy Hunt really worried me. Jeremy Hunt managed to set up his own business. I think he made 16 million. He knows exactly what he was doing. He was Secretary of State for Health while more and more people were dying. I don't think he didn't know. I was quite happy when Boris won. I don't think he's quite as quick as Jeremy. But you've got a party that's utterly split. Because there are always people who are mainstream, mild, One Nation conservative. And you can create a model, it's like the Japanese model, of low taxation, higher quality they have in Japan. We can be that kind of conservative and actually people do pretty well. They live the longest. That group, as exemplified by Philip Hammond, is utterly divorced from the current cabinet. But the current cabinet are the most amazing set of people ever. If you look through their beliefs and what they say they want to happen, they are Night Watchman State people. The Night Watchman State is the idea that we get taxation right down to about 2%. And that 2% pays for an army and a police force. And everything else is privatised. You would have never thought they would have got to this position of power. Having got to it, they don't know what to do. Because the minute they try to do what they want to do, the majority of MPs will stop them. So it's very, very odd. I assume that the Conservative Party is going to split. You can't have that enormous rise of the Brexit Party up and down again and not have a split. You can't have this thing on the screen. This was, the BBC reported this as Labour and the Conservatives do equally badly in the local elections. So when the Conservatives, and they didn't produce a graph, I produced a slightly stupid 3D graph that the BBC likes to do. 3,000 local councillors being lost in May this year. Okay, a lot of them pretended to be independents and so on. But it's a party splitting apart. It's a majority remain party, sorry, majority leave party by its voters. By its members, it is a really, really strong Leave Party. But there's a group who are really in favour of business doing well, and who've got a better sense, or are involved in any of the banks. The tier two banks have already gone. Daiwai Bank, the biggest Japanese bank in London, has moved its chief operating officer and CEO and the money across the channel. It's leaving what is now the back office, which was its main European headquarters, in London for 12 years. And it says, and many of the other TT banks say, it doesn't matter what we do now. Because the point of being in London, despite the enormous expense, despite all the other difficulties of trying to operate in that city and get staff and everything else, the point was that they were safe because British governments would look after banking. There are no arrangements for passporting whatsoever. There is nothing. We could, on the 1st of November, become Morocco. Our banks will have the same rights and the same safety as banks based in Morocco. And you may think I'm being alarmist about this, but they're backed up by sterling. What backs sterling up now? So I think you're looking to split. And it could be a split for a very long time. That then makes PR more likely. As soon as we've got PR, we have at least 8 or 9 or 10 parties. And the great thing then is we all get a little party we like. You know, I've had to spend my whole life not voting for something I quite wanted. I can, you know, you can tell I'm an awkward person. My party would probably be a really, really tiny party. But it'll get one member of parliament in. And that's a huge difference from what we have at the moment, where the majority of people at each election do not get the political party they vote for into power. Or even worse, you have to do deals because of the way things work, where you completely alter what you promised the electors you would do, for instance, abolish tuition fees, to actually be able to form an alliance with the other party. That kind of level of Machiavellian doesn't happen in mainland European countries. It's quite a lot, but not this about turn that we get. Next election could be SNP Labour, and that could be interesting. Because although they're very, very similar on policies, the SNP are really, really interested in leaving. So I do wonder what the deal will be. But they won't even talk about that till after the elections. They know they have to talk about it. It's all over the place. The last time the third biggest party in Britain was a nationalist party, as it is now, the last time the third biggest party was nationalist, as like the SNP, was 1918, when it was Sinn Féin, and the Republic left. So that's the kind of historical portent for where we are. It's exciting, it's interesting, it need not be a disaster. It could be very, very good. Our children and grandchildren could live through times of increasing equality, greater sustainability. We might even think they should learn other languages. Because you can only think, oh, we're just learning one language. If you think we're so, so important that people will always come to us and will always think like us and always talk like us. So I am generally optimistic about this. I think the alternative of no referendum having happened or Remain just having won slightly is actually worse than this. This is an accelerated process of learning and change that we're currently going through. Sorry, I promise to be shorter.
Those of us who want to remain sometimes blamed the media, not so much in the run-up to the election, but the sort of drip feed of the decades before and media ownership. Now, are we right to do so, or is that a bit of a myth?
When I discuss it with my friends, there's multiple people. One of the myths is that there's no such thing as... Right, so there's no such thing as no deal. There's WTO terms, we'll get away with it. We can crash out and we'll be fine, which I obviously completely disagree with, but I haven't actually done enough reading to deny it, so I was wondering if you could share some more on that.
Okay. Sorry, first question again, my memory's... Media ownership. Italy has bad media ownership as well. But it's only Italy that we compare to in Europe. The States is worse. I think we kind of get the media we deserved, if you like. It's a media that went very well without this idea of superiority. Superiority from the BBC, speaking truth unto nations. That kind of idea. The jingoistic media fits our background. Murdoch did come in, and Murdoch is very, very pro-leave because Europe may control Murdoch's behaviour just as it controls the behaviour of hedge funds and so on. So he's the one, I think, if you're going to worry about any one individual, that I'd worry about the most. But I think our media is partly a reflection of how subservient we were willing to be. I have one graph which compares the rate at which people demonstrate in different European countries. The second most boring country in all of Europe, for whether you've ever... Who here has ever been on a demonstration or a march? Okay, you're not normal. No. Yeah. The second most boring country in Europe is Germany, where only one in three adults have been on a march or protest. But the UK is one in six. We're really well behaved, really subservient. Do this with our forelock, know our place. And where did that come from? Or further, why do we have these public schools? What was that about? Well, we had the public schools where, you know, originally for poor boys, and then they became bigger and bigger and greater and greater. Because they're brilliant training grounds to run an empire. You need to take a small boy away from their parents, put them there, have a bit of a beating to them when they're very small, teach them then when they get a bit bigger to beat the smaller boy. Tell them that they're so special that they need nowadays £35,000 a year spent on their education, and that they should only go to one of the two elite universities because they're elite. One in three boys from Eton does that, the other two out of three poor children think they failed. It's a perfect education for running a colony. The problem is if you don't have a colony anymore, then you kind of do it in on yourself, so it's tricky. I do think we need a better sort of out medium in future, and that requires some laws about monopoly owning. We need to tax them, we need to look at the Nundon status. You know, having two men on a small island in the Channel owning the Telegraph, you know, what on earth? It's like a Tintin book. I see. WTO rules. That's a series of tariffs that have to be immediately applied the next day. There are rules and practicalities. We know there are not enough medicines. We know that the planning and even the buying most more fridges than anybody else has ever bought before isn't going to work. The medicine I'm most interested in, although insulin and other life dependables are really important, about 1 in 10 of us are currently on Prozac or the equivalent. There are not the stockpiles, you can't stockpile it. So we're suddenly all going to come off together. It's not necessarily good. The thing that most worries me, if you remember the Y2K bug, where nothing actually meant what?
Yeah.
Okay? Now this is different. Because we've got some ideas as to some of the things that will go wrong, but there'll be things that we just haven't imagined, because it's all been so unimaginable. You can work out they won't. I read the 70 documents that they produced. So about 2 years ago, 70 documents. And my favourite document, advice in the event of Brexit document, my favourite one was what to do if you're in charge of a civic nuclear facility. Now, I bet none of you have read the what to do if you're in charge of a civic nuclear facility. I'm allowed to because I am. The scholars and fellows of the University of Oxford, we own about 3 of them. And the document says the government will match the European funding up until December 2019. Wait for it. And then we suggest you seek professional advice. Full stop, end of advice. There's two things. One is making sure you've got enough money for the redundancy payments. That's relatively easy. The harder one is finding out what kind of concrete is it that you need to get to pour over the reactors, which will then be sealed forever. This is my big way about, yeah. We can organise things, we can queue. We're good at queuing. Right, my favourite one, I'll give you a flippant one, but this way. My flippant one, this has to do with my weight. This is really the only hope for me at this point in my age. If it is a hard Brexit, my one plea, if you can write in to your MP and suggest this, I would like Weight Watchers to be given the contract for the rationing. And then every week we go along and we get weighed. And within a week, we can go, I do lots of numbers, currently on a par with Hungary, we are the fattest Europeans. I don't know why the Hungarians are so fat. Probably lack of immigrants. probably on the good side of Brexit, is it not possible that within 1 year, we could go from being the equal fattest nation in Europe to being the most svelte, slim, perfectly proportioned set of Adonises that there have ever been. Just requires, just suggest it to your MP and let them take the credit. Weight Watchers have got lots and lots of scales, so they rely on people yo-yoing to come back and back again. But this could get rid of all the yo-yo diets. More seriously, I looked into the potato harvest, because potatoes were a nice solid food that we could grow and take in. The potato harvest failed last year because it was too hot. What do you think the potato harvest is doing right now? It's failing, yeah. So there won't be enough food as long as we distribute the food okay. And it's working out things like that that really matter. It's the cash points. Ultimately, it's the cash points. And the cash point's still working on the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th of November. This is not alarmist to say. This is what happened in Greece. They simply stopped working. It's the credit of the banks. what do you think the credit rating of Britain's major banks will be in the event of a disorderly exit with no deal? Exactly. You know, the £85,000 that the government guarantees that they will cover in your bank account, it's very nice of them, but where are they going to get it from? Right? So it's that. It's unlikely. We're not that stupid. It's a chance now for our members of Parliament to show that they can work together. Right? And if they can't work together on this, really, it is a miserable indictment on all their CVs. I don't think it's going to come to this kind of a disaster, but it's just worth bearing in mind it is possible, not as Project Fear, but as what can you do for yourself and your neighbours if things get really bad. And we've become a very insular country where we don't tend to look after our neighbours and ourselves as much as other people in the rest of Europe do. One reason why our life expectancy has been falling is that elderly people, particularly elderly women who live on their own, have been dying earlier in their own homes, and none of their neighbours knew who they were. And that kind of thing needs to end. And there will be a silver lining no matter how bad it is. At least we'll get to know who else lives in our street. I'll try to be more upbeat.
On that note of silver linings, I'm afraid that's all we have time for today.
We have this one question. She's been waiting for the last answer to finish.
Oh, go on. Really near your mouth.
It's a bit flippant. You made the comment about English. How do we stop the rest of the world speaking better English than we do?
But it's annoying to realise how dramatically better students whose first language isn't English is. He says, don't make me. We have to start learning other languages. One thing which is happening already, which you may have noticed, we no longer own the English language in any way. It is going to rapidly, rapidly change. It is now a universal language, out of us and out of the United States control. Young people from around the world can speak it. It has become normal. We mustn't get angry about that. It will have gone from us. It's a universal language because we have the largest empire the world has ever known. But we need to start learning how other people speak. And if we do that, we can begin to learn how they think. Because we have been thinking in a particular way for a very long time that comes from when we actually realised we were on top of the world and we decided to told ourselves it was something special about us that meant that we were number one. Now, clearly it's time to realise somebody had to be number one and it happened to be us, and as amazing specimens as we are, there isn't actually a genetic reason why the British were rich or should be rich and at the top in future. Thank you very much.